SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, are presenting the Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds, which will be held on the first Sunday of each month. The title of this Grand Rounds is Global Solutions to Clinical Challenges in Neurosurgery. For this Grand Rounds, a major topic will be management of penetrating wounds to the skull, presented by Professor N.J.M. Magwambi from Kenya. And a guest speaker discussant, Nancy Epstein, discussing practical solutions for spine surgery. Other discussions come from Africa, Argentina, France, Iraq, Persia, and the United States. Moderators are Estrada Bernard and James Hausman.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed colleagues, welcome to the Global Solutions to Clinical Challenges in Neurosurgery. This is the first in a series that's being sponsored by SNI Digital. And I want to thank Professor Hausman for putting this together. This is a great opportunity to transcend geographical borders and bring people together to promote neurosurgery and make a difference around the world. This is a conference that's for sharing knowledge. It's a collaborative space, and I encourage wide and active participation by everyone. We're privileged to have experts from Africa and experts from around the globe essentially collaborating. So I think this is exciting and look forward to moving this forward. And thanks again, Dr. Hausman. And also just want to mention that we're privileged to have Dr. Nancy Epstein, who's the Editor-in-Chief of Surgical Neurology International Journal, who will be making some special presentations and actively engaged in our program. So welcome. Thank you very much. And Jim, if you like to say anything further, please do, and then we can start the program.
Okay, I'll just take a few minutes and introduce everybody. First of all, our gratitude is to Gilbert, who has spent 30 years developing educational programs through Africa. His commitment is unparalleled, and he's just done a superb job. And with his advice, we're proceeding. And Professor Ngwambi, I think everybody knows, has a distinguished career and is a major national, if not a continental figure in Africa in neurosurgery, has achieved great success. Nancy Epstein, everyone knows, has been a spine surgeon for 40 years, has written more than probably most people in academia, and is editor of Surgical Neurology. Estrada is head of neurosurgery at the University of North Carolina, was trained at Duke, and has been very instrumental in helping us get going here. Saeed Kansari is from Persia, was trained in France. Hospital, what was the hospital you were trained in?
Henri Mondor Hospital, okay. In the suburb of the Paris.
And so Gilbert knows that, and is now in UCLA. Samer Hose is from Iraq. We have people from five continents on the talk today. And he's been extremely active with young people. He's got a program we have to hear about in the future. He's mentored 1,000 young people so they can move on and get into various phases of medicine and neurosurgery. He's a hybrid neurosurgery or both vascular, interventional. He's had great experience with trauma in there in Iraq, and heard presentations before that have been, the person next to him was head of intensive care at Johns Hopkins and said, we ought to all listen to you. You know more than we do. Jorge Lazarev is pediatric neurosurgeon, from Argentina. He's traveled all over the world, as has everybody else here, and has just got back from China. And we have another person who's going to join us, who is Chandrasekhar Deo Pujari. He's in Bombay. He's head of neurosurgery at the Bombay Hospital, been involved in pediatric neurosurgery up in Toronto. He was a fellow with us for a while, and also is an adult neurosurgeon, a tremendous experience, and very interested in the kinds of things we're doing. So without further ado, let me tell you a few things about what we do. We want a lot of discussion, and we don't want you to take it and personally. It's something we believe is different than what most teaching is. Experience has shown that if people just listen to a lecture, they get about 20% that they learn. If they have a lecture with some slides or information, they may learn 40% or so. If they get lecture slides and discussion, the learning goes up to 90%. So we've done that. I know Gilbert has found that in his work in Africa. And so that's, people may ask questions, and we want them to participate so they learn something. Okay, Professor, would you like to go ahead?
Okay, I think, thank you very much, Professor Osman and your team for coordinating this. It's a major step forward, and it will help us a lot from Sub-Saharan Africa to be able to have a discussion, exchange cases which we have managed, and sometimes exchange cases which we would like to manage and get opinion from experts. And therefore, this will be very, very beneficial to practicing neurosurgeons as well as to residents. And we here from Nairobi, Kenya, as you can see, what I'll be presenting will be work effort of several neurosurgeons, myself, Dr. Musau, Dr. Kiboi, Dr. Akuku, Dr. Olunya, Dr. Mwangi, Dr. Ekesa, Dr. Gichuhi, who is a an ophthalmologist, and Dr. Odhiambo, who's a radiologist, Dr. Njiru, Dr. Mohan, and all these neurosurgeons initially were based at Kenyatta National Hospital. And some of them have now qualified, and they're based at Moi Teaching and Referral Hospital in Eldoret. And of course, myself, I've moved on, and I'm no longer at Kenyatta National Hospital, but I'll be sharing this case, which we managed with my colleagues about 10 years ago, two cases. We shall present two cases of penetrating head injury, which we managed in Kenya. As an example of penetrating head injuries which we encounter in our region, and where there was a joint management effort by the neurosurgeons, neuro-ophthalmologist, and neuroradiologist. Our first case is a male, age 24, who came with a history of assault at his place of work. Our patients tend to present late, but fortunately, this patient came within 2 hours of assault, so it was quite fast. His vital signs were stable. He was confused. He was bleeding from the wound, and there was a knife protruding from the left frontal aspect of the forehead. His Glasgow Coma Scale was 14. Right eye was normal, but the left eye, there was subconjunctival hemorrhage with chemosis, and was examined by the ophthalmologist, who confirmed that the eye was functional and had not been involved in that injury, although it was the knife had passed very near it. We started him on the usual treatments, put him on antibiotics and all the usual things. And then we did a skull X-rays, which we would like to share with you. These were the skull X-rays which we did. And as you can see, fortunately, whoever stabbed him never took out the knife. And probably this may have helped him a bit, because when he presented He had this knife which was there, and it hadn't been pulled out by whoever had assaulted him. We did a plain radiograph, which you can see there. And of course, it shows the knife going right there near the base of the skull, very deep, deep. And we had the advantage of doing a CT scan of the head, and you can see the images are not so clear, but again, it demonstrated the extent of penetration of that knife, and how it had gone almost into the sphenoid ear sinus, and the length of the knife. This again, that's the CT scan. You can see it there. Now, we proceeded to prepare him for surgery. And you can see there, when he has been anesthetized and we're able to take the left top image, you can be able to see the knife there, how it penetrated on that aspect. And what we did is we raised a bifrontal craniotomy. You can see the traditional incision which was made there. And this incision then was incorporated to involve the site of penetration of that knife. And from
just
there,
can I just ask a question for a minute? When you were doing this case, obviously you want to leave in the penetrating injury, you know, you want to leave the knife in place. Did you think about, you know, cutting it off?
The knife was left in place.
Excuse me?
That the knife was left in place while we made the incision. So
but my question is, could you have cut off the handle? Because it'd be easier to prep and drape the tip of the knife that you leave in place rather than the whole handle and everything else, so that it's a more sterile field.
Yes, okay, that's a good point. That is, could we have covered but what you'll notice is the draping which we have done on the wound. If you check carefully, you'll find the draping which we have done on the wound. You know, we didn't cover the knife itself, but it has isolated that side. But that's a good point you have made. That could probably could have as well have covered the handle, wrapped it before making the incision.
Yeah, I would advise not to even touch the knife. I have a different point. I would have advised not to even touch the knife as you did, because in the hands of residents and trainees, one important point is to always let them know that they shouldn't touch anything. Because in trying to touch or cut it, you cause more damage because it's going to move. It's going to cut more structures. So I would advise the other way.
Well, what was very obvious with this patient, the knife was very well lodged. So it was hardly movable. So it's, and the patient would came walking with the knife quite lodged in. I mean, it had impacted very well and was hardly moving. Therefore, that's a safety aspect which we had as we prepared him for surgery. That the knife was...
as you're doing the operation, then you have to have somebody underneath the drapes pulling out the knife so that you can follow it down, correct? Eventually?
Well,
I personally am not there, but I... No, they wouldn't have done that because, you know, the knife is a strong knife and cutting it is going to cause a lot of troubles, and holding it is, I mean, just leave it as it is and keep working towards it until you get to the base and then you deal with it.
Okay.
Isn't that potentially going to increase the damage and exposure of surrounding nerve tissue eventually as you're following the track down?
Well, let's let Professor go ahead and finish a little, and then we can talk. We can talk some more. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, now, Professor. if you look from the flap which we have raised, we raised the flap, and we incorporated the you know, we extended the incision so that we incorporated the entry point of the knife.
Right.
And then after we had incorporated the entry point of the knife, then we cut bar holes to raise a bone flap and nibbled around the knife. So where the knife had penetrated we did like a craniectomy so that we had that loose end there. And then after that, of course, removed the bone flap. Right. Remove the bone flap. So after having removed the bone flap, then now we're able to work around the edges of the knife and followed the knife downwards up to the with hemostasis up to where it had lodged itself, and we're able to actually remove it safely without any problems. And with this patient, we didn't do any other investigations. We didn't do like vascular studies, no, like the next patients, which I'll share with you. This one we didn't do vascular studies. This one we only did the CT scan, and from the CT scan and from the penetration of the knife, we were quite positive. We were quite sure that there were no vessels which were involved around that area. And fortunately, you know, we I must say some of these surgeries, of course, luck is always there. So I think luck was on our side. So we did, we were able to complete that and return the bone flap, anchor it. And you can see from the left lower image, you can see the knife now, which has been removed. And you can see from this, the bifrontal craniotomy incision together with the extension, okay, which we did to incorporate the site of penetration. And that is how we worked on that. And of course, after that, from the images which you'll see on the right, the patient, after the surgery, he was extubated. We didn't keep him under intubation. He was extubated. And he was able to make a good recovery. You can see from this, this is the incisions which we went through. You can see that's the incision where he had been stabbed. Okay, you can look at the left image, and then the incision which we made on that side. And after about 7-10 days, he had recovered. And we'll say that because this was the frontal lobe, you know, he was very, very fortunate. So therefore, you can see he's able to move his limbs quite comfortably and we eventually were able to let him go home. And I can stop there and get any comments on that case
before I go to the next. When you performed your initial CT, you could have done a CTA to CT angiogram in order to get a look at some of the vessels.
We always face those challenges sometimes in our setup because these patients pay for these these investigations, and each investigation costs money, and these patients usually don't have insurance cover. So we find that we would like to do some more investigations, but we are hindered by financial constraints.
Excellent. Yes, Jorge, you wanted to say?
No, I had a similar case here in the United States, like 20 years ago, somebody coming from Southeast Los Angeles. And we proceeded more or less, was a shorter knife. So it was possible to actually do the prepping and draping similarly to, I mean, without the concerns that Dr. Epstein raised. And it was a child, was a 12-year-old, no? A child, but sometimes not a child. And in rounds after, I was chastised for not having done an angio before. CT angio or at a plain angio. And I always wonder, is one of those cases that stuck in it in my mind and say how lucky we were by when... After all the exposure, there is one moment that you have to pull the knife, no, with the blade, everything and like that. So in one sense, I agree with Dr. Epstein, absolutely, that perhaps in the ideal situation, in the ideal circumstances, as I had here in the United States, not somewhere else, an angio or a CT angio is very informative. On the other hand, I am extremely pleased that this gentleman, as my patient, did very well because it's a way of saying, "Oh, shoot!" But I was reviving at a nightmare here in the United States, not in sub-Saharan Africa. So yes, maybe angio or CT angio in the ideal condition is something useful to keep in mind. But thank you, Nimrod, because we now have two cases without angio and knife that did well.
Yes. It's, I agree with Dr. Edelstein.
I trained with Joe Rantzoff at NYU, said it's better to be lucky than good.
Yeah. That's good. We are very lucky.
Yeah, I think that's true. I have a question for the professor. I think the moment of truth is certainly when you withdraw the knife, and I was concerned that knife could have been perhaps in the cavernous sinus. So at what point did you withdraw the knife? It sounds like you made an exposure, at least for part of the way. Did you expose all the way down to the near the tip before you withdrew the knife? But what was your process? Now,
as I said, this was a teamwork. So what I would like to emphasize is that this surgery was done by the residents, assisted by the neurosurgeon who was on call. And the resident who did this is now a neurosurgeon in Eldoret. That was Dr. Mohan and Dr. Njiru. They were the two residents who really handled this case, and they were assisted by the neurosurgeon who was on call. And the knife was not withdrawn. The knife was dissected up to gradually on around it. So a dissection was done around it with hemostasis until you reached the point where the blade of the knife, the tip of the knife, and at that stage, then now the knife was carefully.
It's also interesting because the knife clearly tapers a lot. So basically they followed it down with cottonoids along the path of the knife, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, as you now retrospectively, of course, you know, as I said, we were just lucky because, you know, we didn't do angio, and we didn't know how was the vascular challenges which would have arisen. We didn't know that with this case, we're just lucky. And as I said, sometimes these are the constraints you work under. And what happens is when now you reach that level and you encounter a vascular problem, then now you see how you handle it at that stage.
Yeah. But in this time, you could actually have interventional radiology available in the OR with you to embolize or whatever tricks they needed to help you if there was massive bleeding, correct?
Well, I'm not sure they have that.
Do you have interventional radiology capacity there?
No, I am here. I don't know whether you can hear me. This is 10 years ago. We had not reached that level yet in our interventional work. Now we are quite advanced, and some of this work can be shared with our colleagues.
Anyway, let me see if I can make a point here.
Sure. Go ahead.
I still, even up to date, even if it's today, in my practice, fortunately, I've encountered a lot of these stab wounds, both in the head and in the spine. And the principles are always the same. You don't try to move the knife. You don't try to touch it. And in the hands of residents, they become so enthusiastic, or if I could use the word over-enthusiastic, that everybody is like, okay, let's touch it. Let's do this. And the more radiology you try to do, yes, you get good information, but the more the risks you stand of moving that knife and cut more.
It's a very good
into it. Now, interventional radiology in our part of the world should not be a conventional yardstick. I think that we should always look at the context in which something is being done, what we have to utilize to do that, and what are the basic principles. And I think that even if it happens today, Professor Munger, I will still coincide with what they did. Keep it still, go in as much as possible, dissect through it, get into the base, remove it, and you will be very fine. But if you try to do many more things, then you get more into trouble.
Right. I can remember years ago in New York City at St. Vincent's Hospital, the patient was admitted and they had a Dixie cup on their back, and actually radiographically it did a myelotomy. And in that patient, we actually did that patient prone, kept the patient awake, used local anesthesia, followed that right down through the cord, you know, using local anesthesia, took it all out, and the patient ended up neurologically intact. So the whole point is, yes, you have to take off the Dixie cup, but don't remove the penetrating object.
I think a terrific discussion, because these are emergent problems, and that's the first thing is people, so what should I do? And I think we've had a good discussion about that. Professor Mwangi, I think your people did a superb job following it down and seeing if you could do that. I know you have another case. I just want to stop here for a minute. I welcome the people who have just joined us. This is the first Sub-Saharan International Neurosurgical Grand Rounds. Professor Mwangi from Kenya has presented this case that they had some years ago with a penetrating injury. You can see the knife there. And we had some discussion as to you remove this right away. They did a craniotomy around it and then followed it down. Then we were able to remove it under direct vision. That summarized it correctly, Professor?
Yes, you have summarized it correctly.
I'd like to welcome Griff Harsh. Griff, it's nice to see you. I know you spent a lot of time also in your donating your time in Africa, so we appreciate your being here. Samer, you've had a huge experience in Baghdad. I don't want you to give your talk. You were going to give a little later, but you've had a huge experience with some penetrating injury. Do you have some comments at this point? You want to wait till later?
Yeah, I think I like the description of the case and to be focus of discussion. And maybe similar to Dr. Lazarev, I have very similar case, maybe running more through skull base. I think with the same made a model of the knife, it's just interesting. I think few points mentioned by Dr. Mwangi that the commonly patient usually presented late because the system and the emergency cars and those things is not that well settled, usually in peripheral area or the area draining multiple injuries. And basically those are transporting car, not really emergency cars. So being lucky for the patient is also because he will be exposed to many people through the way until he reached the emergency department. That's what usually happen around the world. And I would be, I totally agree with the NGO thing that most of the patient, you will lose follow-up and you don't have a long-term follow-up for pseudoneurism or something like that in general. I would be interested to know if there's any antiseptic technique like out of guideline, because sometimes we use something that sometimes hydrogen peroxide, sometimes local gentamicin, regardless of the guideline, but those are expected to be not clean surgery. So whatever available we may use, what's your experience, sir?
Now, as you said, many of these cases which we see actually come late. And this was a very unusual case because it came 2 hours from the time of trauma, of assault. And this was one of the advantages that after the surgery, the complications, we didn't have this issue of complications as would have happened if the patient had come late. So that's one of the great advantages we had. But then we must bear in mind that in our setup, many of the cases are usually referred. And usually they will be coming 6, 8, 12 hours, or even 24 hours late. And then sometimes some of these cases, it's almost very difficult to refer them because of the nature of those injuries. And you'll find that in many situations in our setup, fortunately, we have neurosurgeons now in many of the peripheral areas, so they may be able to do the initial management of the case. But this is a very complicated case, which needs a lot of backup, and therefore the neurosurgeons in some of those peripheral hospitals will still face those challenges. So the advantage we have with this case is that it occurred in Nairobi, and Nairobi is a very, very metropolitan place, and with a lot of advantages of transport, etc. So this patient was able to be brought to hospital within 2 hours from the time he was assaulted at his place of work. We still don't know why he was assaulted at his place of work. No, those details we couldn't find out.
Okay. I'd just like to address and then
the other one is that we don't usually use topical antibiotics. So we just, even if the patient comes late, we just manage. If the patient comes with a wound, which is, let's say, over 24 hours, we just manage as we would manage a potentially infected wound. So we don't usually use local antibiotics. And the use of hydrogen peroxide, during my teaching with the residents in the earlier years, we reserved that for very, very special situations, but it was not routinely used, hydrogen peroxide.
I just like to comment on the hydrogen peroxide, because in spine surgery, actually, we routinely used it. My father was a neurosurgeon. He was trained by Davidoff at Albert Einstein in the 40s and the 50s, and he used it for decades, and we've used it for decades. So at least in spine, we haven't had any adverse reactions to it, and I think it really helps. And it hyperoxygenates the wound as well.
Okay. Anybody else want to ask any questions?
Doctor, one thing. Thank you very much for sharing this idea. Professor, it was very nice, and we have seen it once in a while. But the problem we have in Los Angeles, mostly gunshot wound, because they have more advanced, and everybody shots on the head, and that's a different story. And the other thing that Dr. Epstein brought is that I remember in France, for the brain abscesses, we had to irrigate them with betadine. And that was helping, because betadine is very safe for using on the brain. So maybe to consider that for irrigation of the gunshot wound or on the stab wound like that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any comments? Anybody else want to comment? Because I know you have a second case, Professor.
I'll ask a question. So, Professor, sure. What was the duration of the antibiotic treatment, and what is your recommendation? There are many guidelines that recommend antibiotics, but it's not based on prospective data. It's most of the data is just case series. So, it's not really clear, and there's some controversy about using antibiotics prophylactically. One of the concerns is that you might select out resistant organisms, but that notwithstanding, what is your customary practice for duration of antibiotic treatment?
The duration, now the guidelines on with this type of patient who comes almost within 6 hours of trauma is to consider it as a case where you give antibiotics during induction and then continue for up to about sometimes 76 hours. But we don't prolong it more than that.
What if you have a drain in place? Are you using it until the drain comes out?
We don't leave drains these type of trauma cases, because there's really no indication for leaving a drain. Most times.
Okay.
You don't have problems with post-op seromas?
Well, I don't know. It's remember that leaving a drain sometimes in our situation, sometimes a drain brings more problems than solves the problems because of the environment where we work. So you have to really... Because, again, the type of drain which we would have to leave is like the vacuum drains. The patient has to buy those, and they're very expensive. So you find with those...
Or just a gravity drain. A gravity drain which is usually safer because you don't want to suck out the spinal fluid, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Okay.
But most of the trauma cases, we don't leave drains.
Okay.
So, Estrada, I think we have... A second case. We had a terrific discussion there. Professor, you have a second case your group wanted to present. Is that correct?
Yes, I have a second case, another very interesting case, again, penetrating injuries.
Okay,
now, this is a pediatric case. It's a 1.5-year-old child, and the history was from the father. Unfortunately, this was quite sometime, about 10 years ago, 2014. And what happened is there was sort of like terrorist attacks which were taking place. Not really, I wouldn't really call them terrorists, but thugs, people shooting in a neighborhood. And as that was happening, the mother of this child wrapped herself, covered her child so that, you know, the guns which were being thrown throughout didn't injure the child. And then the bullet went through the mother and the mother died. And then the bullet now went to the child, hit the child. So at that stage, now it was a low velocity, So then the child, the bullet entered, the child didn't lose consciousness. But then when people went, they found the mother had been killed. And the child she was holding the child with this bullet, which had entered into the head. The child was very, very stable with GCS of 15 over 15. And there was a scalp wound entry at the site where the child had been, where the bullet had entered. And now this was about 500 kilometers from Nairobi, because it occurred in a town which is a seaside town called Mombasa. So this patient now was referred to Nairobi for further management, but because the patient was quite stable, was able to make the journey. This is the child, and as you can see, this is the entry wound where the bullet had entered, and now the issue here, of course, was to plan on the removal of this bullet and its feasibility. So x-rays were done. This is the initial x-ray which was done, and you can see the bullet had entered in that wound and traveled down and lodged quite deep down there.
Was there any discussion or consideration of leaving the bullet in place?
Yeah, that's I'm going to come into that.
Okay.
So this is where the bullet had, the x-ray showed that the bullet had lodged quite deep. And a CT scan was done, and the CT scan was able to localize the bullet. Now, we discussed the feasibility of leaving the bullet, and because it was quite a deep-seated bullet, and we discussed these possibilities of leaving this bullet. And some cases we have left the bullet, especially if the patient is very, very stable and there's no need to remove it. But with further investigations, some neurosurgeons said, why don't we try to see if we can remove the bullet? And I think the neurosurgeons who were for removing the bullet, you know, won the day. And then, of course, you have to remember that when this happened, this was a situation where the political environment was very, very tense, because the injury had occurred as a result of some political tensions in that area. And therefore, everybody was we want this bullet removed. And why don't you people try to remove it? So we did some more investigations, and now this one we did angio, digital subtraction angiographies were done, and the bullet was able to be found that it had not caused any damage to the vessels. And again, from there, we was able to judge as to whether it was approachable. And from that, as you can see from the trajectory, if you look at this trajectory from where it had entered, it seemed as though it probably we could get into it without necessarily getting into any of the vessels. And then what we did is we did more images, and in these images were just trying to find out the path which this bullet had taken, and see whether from that we can see from the entry and where it was, as to whether it's possible to try to remove this bullet. Now, again, this was done by one of our very experienced neurosurgeons, and they went in, and from the images, they were able to sort of like see if they could feel the bullet. And because we didn't have facilities for any further intra-op localization. So, and from that, they were able to dissect and actually follow the path of that bullet where it had entered, and get to the bullet, and able to remove the bullet. As you can see, that's the bullet on the top left-hand side. And very, very successfully, but this was a very experienced neurosurgeon, and the child did very well. As I said, this was a case which had a lot of politics involved. And in fact, and remember, the mother had died. So after this, the child was actually adopted by one of our very senior politicians. And now he's doing very, very well, and getting on with his life.
But going backward, isn't yes. there a discussion that a lot of these penetrating bullet injuries, the bullet ends up really being sterile by the time it goes intracranially? So the whole discussion of leaving it behind, can you just re-explore that?
Yes, we in fact, which when the patient comes, when the patient comes with the bullet injuries, we manage these patients as per their clinical status. So like there was another case which I wanted to present, but because of time, I won't be able to present, where again, we left the bullet inside because the bullet had entered, and now we had to manage that patient for raising the clinical pressure and all that. And the bullet had moved from one hemisphere to the next hemisphere. And what we did is we managed the patient for raising the blood pressure severely, and he recovered. And after he recovered, we did not bother to go back and remove that bullet.
Okay, can I make a comment here? In my setup, which is in Ghana, is also West Africa. What do we do when we see that? I mean, 20 years ago, we might have adopted a different approach. But what we do for the last years will be to use the navigation system, the neural navigation, and then ultrasound. We measure exactly where the bullet is, and if there is the possibility of doing any cartography, where you can actually see the anatomy that we have, and we measure and we see how deep it is, whether using an ultrasound or the navigation system, we can decide to just leave it in and observe. And if with the position, it comes out, then we might contemplate going in for it. But if it's that deep seated, we could just leave it and keep observing with time and do serial radiographic images, and then you take a decision. Thank you.
Professor Kaba, you've done this a number of times, I'm sure. Is your experience good?
All right. So in my setup, sometimes we get a bullet, a unique bullet, and sometimes most of the bullets are locally made. So they are actually pearls that are in multiple and small, and we don't go up for all of them. Yes, last week we had one in the spine, and we took what we could take, and the rest, when we did the measurement, we noticed most of them were not actually in the canal, but in the muscles. So we just leave them, and then we keep observing. And those in the brain, if it's accessible, we go in. But if it's exceeded, we just calculate to look at how much would you damage. Is it in an eloquent area? What are the structures you're going to find? And sometimes one thing I try to teach my residents is
excellent.
Not about technology. It's about common anatomy. We know how the brain is. We know the structures. where is it located? Then you complement it with technology and you confirm it and you take a decision.
I think Dr. Kalba's points are very well taken. One of the primary reasons for extracting these penetrating missiles would be to reduce the risk of infection, and the data isn't, well, actually there's some data indicating that you may not reduce the risk of infection with an exploration. You run the risk of neurologic injury. But I think the confounding factor in this case was that the missile had penetrated the mother prior to entering the child. So I'm wondering if that might have changed the dynamics and increased the risk for infection.
I do agree. I think the purpose of this joint collaborative effort is to look at before, now, and forward. Before, 20 years ago, I would have looked at this differently. Today, one of the things that in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa specifically, we should be looking at is maximizing the use of the ultrasound. It's cheap, it's bedside, you don't need anything to complement to it, and it gives you so much information, and it helps a lot. And we use it almost every day, and it helps a lot to take a decision. So for the future, we can look at it. And the probes determine what it is. Depending on the type of probe you use, you would just that entrance in a hockey stick probe, you could.
Sammer, do you have any comments on this? And going after, you had a number of many cases with gunshot wounds. Well, how did you treat them any differently?
First, congratulations, Dr. Mondoki, for the case. It's very realistic scenario, let's say. I totally agree with the political aspect, and sometimes you are one of the indications that's not common in high-income country. It's you are simply forced to do some type of surgery for whatever reason, mostly non-scientific. It's common thing. And a few points just in a hurry that sometimes longer bullets have some part that's not blasted yet. So there is a risk. Sometimes we use the rubber tipped instrument while dealing with that, because there is a risk of secondary blast inside the in the tip of bullet. Sometimes we use the EVD or the upper end of the shunt to follow the track of the bullet, just to trace the track. Occipital injuries in general have a better outcome. Child have better outcome if he survived the initial injury. Also, for the positioning one, the horizontal alignment, we actually published a paper on that, that sometimes in a very similar example, if we try strict positioning, the bullet with the time, will settle back on the track. And there is some.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do something, or I'm going to mute everybody. Go ahead, Samer. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So if it's not vertical, if it's horizontal injury to the head in general, so sometimes we use strict patient positioning, and with the time the bullet will go back to the initial tract and just become more superficial, and you can remove it just easy. But I totally understand, sometimes we remove it, sometimes not. And one of the factors which govern the migration of the bullet, in addition to the comment on the using ultrasound, I really appreciate that, the migration may depend on the location, because I think this type of penetrating usually stop when the bullet hits the tentorium, in that example you just show. And if it's around the ventricle, if it's within the subarachnoid space, this is a definite indication or a more probable indication to intervene and remove the bullet, because there is a high potential for migration. But yeah, I totally agree with the management of this case based on the circumstances mentioned. And yeah, congratulations.
Thank you, Samir. Griff, Harsh, you have some experience with this. Would you like to tell us about it?
Just in terms of the bullet, my experience suggests that if one doesn't need to explore on the basis of relief of mass effect from additional bleeding, then one can leave many bullets in without adverse sequelae. In regard to Professor Nim's case, I had an almost identical case at in Kenya 3 weeks ago. Amazing that the patient was never intubated, and the knife was withdrawn successfully after angiography showed no involvement of the vasculature. So different ways of handling it. I do have a very interesting case of a penetration. Is from UC Davis Sacramento, of a penetration of the brain along this same traverse from a nasal entry point to an occipital lodging of the barbed arrow of a longbow. And angiography showed the arrow lodged at the junction of the bifurcation of the internal carotid artery. And here we did a craniotomy at the occipital region so that we could extract the arrow with its barbed tip in an anterograde fashion and not the retrograde fashion, which would have risked injury to the carotid bifurcation had we withdrawn it in a retrograde fashion.
Thank you, Griff. Professor Kava, you wanted to make some more comments.
Yeah, I just want to ask a question. When you have this impact of the bullet on the bone, do you sometimes have to do the cranioplasty immediately, or you leave it and do it at another time, depending on what you see and the possibility of infection? What is your protocol on that? Thank you.
Good question.
Yeah, the cranioplasties are done later on. We don't do the cranioplasties immediately.
Okay. Do you do it immediately, Professor Kava?
Thank you.
No.
We usually wait. At the beginning, we attempted some few, and the results are not good. They come back with infection. You got to remove the cranioplasty material, and it's a cost to the patient. Always let's remember our health insurance system. It's not the same over there. Patient has to pay out of pocket, and most of the time, they cannot afford. So you do the minimum, and then you come back in a given time when you are infection-free, and then you proceed with.
Can I add something in this? Is one important factor is the age of the patient. My experience in penetrating gunshot wounds comes from Mexico, not because of people shooting at each other, but because of New Year's Eve, people shoot with the machine guns to the air. And every now and then, so frequently that has been forbidden for that reason, the bullet will fall down, can get into the very skull of a toddler. And I have seen 4 cases like that in 5 years. And it is an issue that the bullet that comes down in January 1st. January 1st, there is an increase of penetrating wounds in toddlers on in 2, 3, 4 months old babies. And the brain in those kids, in those babies, is not as dense as the brain of a 2 years old and of course of a 15 years old. So it is possible sometimes to force the return of the bullet back to its track closer to the bone, to the place of entry of the bone. So the age, what I'm saying, I mean, each case is individual and each one does whatever they, to the best of their understanding, the situation demands. But yes, often you need to, I mean, you have to consider the possibility that the wound migrates backwards if you force through the position because of the different density of the brain, the different wow. level of myelination of the brain of a 4-month-old, which is totally different, as I said, to a 3, 4, 5, or 1, to at a 50-year-old. And because of that, because of the bone being so thin, yes, we need to do a debridement of the wound, because whereas that the bullet is not infected by the heat, by the penetration, whatever, the scalp can cause some problem in the meninges as such. No? So I think that age of the child is a factor. And if you happen to see a very, very young child, unfortunately victim of this event, considering the tracing back of the wound closer of the bullet closer to the bone. But each surgeon does it individually.
Okay. Thank you. I think Samer, you have a short question, and we want to go on with the program after that.
Yeah, thank you. Short comment on that. Actually, we use a confirmation to Dr. Lazarov's point that we use, it's not a guideline, it's an experience that we use a rule like if the defect less than 5 centimeters and less than 5 years of age, there is no indication for cranioplasty in the future, because with the time the skull will go, and with the time the defect will be much and much smaller and will be less significant. I think this also can be considered related to the cranioplasty in general.
Thank you. Estrada, it seems like I think we should go on just in a second here. Can you stop sharing screen, Nim? And just to this, the case that you have of this young child, what we see there is, and I could just imagine the mother trying to protect the child. It's just a tragedy. And you guys just did a fabulous job, and the discussion was just terrific. And these are all tragedies. So, Estrada, I think maybe we should have Nancy give a talk. It's 9 o'clock. We've already spent about 45 minutes. What do you think?
Yes, excellent. Great discussions. Thank you, Professor Myungvi, for that. Yeah, I think we should proceed with Dr. Epstein's presentation.
Can we ask one question first? I forgot about this. Anybody else have a presentation that they wanted to make? Please let us know. If you do, we can either fit it in today or we can do it in the next meeting. Dr. Sampson, you have a comment? No, anybody else? Okay, go ahead.
Jim, let's just remind everybody to put their microphones on mute so that we can eliminate the extraneous noises. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, Nancy, you want to go ahead? This is for those who joined late. Nancy has been a spine surgeon for 40 years. Her father was a spine surgeon in America, and she's written extensively on spine problems. As you know, she always says things the way they are. The spine industry doesn't like her too much because she's asking where are the factual studies here, and I support that. So Nancy, she's a superb teacher. So Nancy, can you go ahead and give us a talk?
Can everybody see my screen?
Yes, we can see that.
Okay. Yes. So, you know, if people have comments, questions, you know, just interrupt me. I mean, the whole point of today, you know, Jim and I were talking about, you know, what to do. And he was saying, well, why don't we put together something on management of spinal fluid leaks? But as I thought about it, I mean, the most important thing is, especially in spine, is if you do the right operation, you've got a good chance of avoiding them in the first place. And then don't ignore them. Manage them appropriately, diagnose them, and then appropriately treat them. This is an example of obviously a lumbar disc extruded sequestrator fragment that we're removing. This is a figurative diagram of what a CSF leak may look like. One of the references that I'm going to give you later talks about the frequency of disc herniations. It was a study of over 4,000 spine cases frequency of CSF leaks, 1.7% with the lumbar disc, higher with lumbar stenosis, usually ossification of the yellow ligament, very adherent to dura, or might be an ossified synovial cyst, or perhaps just clumsiness and ignorance on the part of the surgeon. But the other thing is also the incidence of reoperations. If you've had prior surgery, the presence of scar obviously markedly increases the risk of a CSF leak. I'll emphasize throughout, and I would ask our audience today, I mean, do you just have access to loops? And how many have access to microscopes? And how many have access to the microscope that's sitting in the corner? Because that may be the access that they should actually take the extra time to get out the microscope and avoid the incidence of CSF leaks.
If they don't have a microscope, loops are certainly the preference, right?
Absolutely. I mean, but the biggest problem you run into is if the surgeon has loops, but the assistant doesn't, that assistant is not as readily going to be able to assist that surgeon during the operation itself, much less to repair the CSF leak. Anybody have any comments on that?
Why don't you go ahead? It's okay.
Okay, that's one of the reasons actually why a microscope is great, because both of you can see what you're doing. I'm just going to start off with, you know, a little bit of the anatomy of the lumbar spine. You know, obviously we have the multiple vertebral bodies. We have the discs here on the right and on the left, the spinous processes. You've got the canal that's obviously in between. Let's not forget the anterior and posterior longitudinal ligaments as well as the yellow ligaments. And here you can see that's the posterior longitudinal ligament, the anterior ligament you've already seen, and the interspinous and supraspinous ligaments of the spine. You can look at things that are going to cause nerve root problems. Everybody forgets, you know, you talk about generally lumbar stenosis. Don't forget about the unilateral lateral recess stenosis that may complicate a disc operation. Might be a good reason not to just use that MRI scan preoperatively, but to get a non-contrast CT to get a better measure of how bad the stenosis may be. As Jim was saying, my father actually was a neurosurgeon. My uncle actually was one of the first neuroradiologists. But here's one of his figurative diagrams. We're going to use what we, you know, discuss with this just as we do with MRs and CAT scans. But here's a unilateral hypertrophied facet. Here's some ossification of the yellow ligament. Between the hypertrophied facet, the ossification of the yellow ligament, you get significant lateral recess stenosis. Remember, you could also have a unilateral synovial cyst that actually may stay lateral or actually go central. But don't forget the presence of stenosis as being a big factor in your designing what operation might be the best operation to use. Again, using adequate exposure is the most critical decision that you're going to make, other than the fact that you may want to choose the correct operation for the correct patient for the correct surgery. Surgical lumbar discs. Degenerative disc, prolapse disc, those are not typically surgical lesions. We see papers all the time of people taking out black discs where there's no neural compression on that MR and CT. Don't operate on those discs. Those patients don't need surgery. But you're going to look at the extruded disc. Here you see figuratively the extruded disc. Extruded disc here on a sagittal MR. It's the disc that has extruded through the fibers of the annulus but are still in continuity with the disc space. The sequestrated disc, the one with the free fragments, this is an example of at the L4-5 level, a large fragment that has herniated inferiorly. I can't emphasize enough how much neurosurgeons and the spinal surgeons need to be able to read their own MRs and CAT scans to localize where the disc herniations happen to be. Not all discs are located at the disc space or just below the disc space. It could be lateral femoral, it could be way far lateral, it could be superiorly migrated, and you have to adjust the operation you're doing to deal with those cases. Lateral disc can cause, again, lateral compression. Here's your typical disc herniation, might be at the disc space, maybe inferiorly migrated, impinging on your inferiorly extruding nerve root. However, put this superiorly, if you're putting it superiorly next to the pedicle, you're getting the superior foraminal root. You're going to have to extend your operative decompression superiorly, or you're going to miss that disc herniation entirely. And I'm just reviewing a medical legal case as we speak that exactly is discussing that. If this disc herniation is way out to the side, you also have to adjust for that far lateral location of the disc. Here on your axial MR, you have a typical extruded disc herniation at the 4-5 level. And here on the sagittal image, again, compression of the corticoina, compression of the nerve root as well ipsilaterally with that disc. Here's an operative image of your typical discectomy. And remember, a lot of us will use intraoperative monitoring, EMG monitoring, SEP, MEP monitoring, depending on the location of where you are. Lumbar spine, you're using typically SEPs and EMGs. Not bad to use your EMG probe. Where is that nerve root during the dissection? You sometimes don't see this nerve root until you've actually taken out the biggest fragment of the disc. The nerve root may be splayed over the disc fragment. You don't want to make your incision into the nerve root and destroy that patient's neurological function and give them a foot drop. The other thing is, I was recently at a meeting where everybody said, well, you do lumbar surgery, well, it's all, you know, the foot. Does it go up or down? Eccentric hallucis, dorsi, and plantar flexors. Everybody's forgetting about the femoral nerve. You know, L2, L12, L23, L34. You've got the L2 to L4 nerve roots that are extruding at those levels. You may present patients who have iliopsoas weakness, quadriceps weakness. They may have a loss of the knee reflex and a sensory defect in the L2 to 4 distribution. And here is certainly the L4 distribution. Everybody's familiar with that. L2, 3 are going to be over the thigh. And here is an example up above of what the MR may look like. Here is 5-1, 4-5, 3-4, and you can see the superiorly extruded disc fragment on your sagittal and parasagittal MRs, and here on your axial study, your sequestrated disc is at the parapedicular level in that case. Just the other day, I saw a patient who, actually she was a friend, she happened to call, she said, you know, I have a real severe leg weakness. And I went to the local medical center and they got a non-contrast CAT scan and they sent me home. And they said, if it gets worse, then go to an emergency room. I said, well, give me permission to read your study. I read the CAT scan. It showed a massive sequestrated synovial cyst extrusion at the L3-4 level, almost filling the spinal canal. I told her, come right back. We've got to get a stat MR prior to the MR. I asked her to lift up her leg. She had iliopsoas and quadriceps weakness, severe. I also asked her, when was the last time, you know, you voided? And she said, well, I haven't urinated today because I didn't drink very much in the morning. Well, we got the MR. It showed the massive synovial cyst extrusion and stenosis at 3-4 that was there on the CAT scan, but had actually been missed on the reading, and also showed the massively dilated bladder. Long story short, she went for surgery. She did have a bladder retention problem. Postoperatively, ended up neurologically intact because she was operated on within 6 hours. Again, you have to be able to recognize these things. The sciatic nerve. Here's a classic example of an axial MR at the 5-1 level. Here's your extruded disc herniation, filling the left side of the spinal canal, obliterating the S1 nerve root. Here's your thecal sac, well, some compression, not terrible, and your right-sided S1 nerve root. Here, we're working actually from the contralateral side of the table to take out a right-sided disc herniation at the L5-S1 level.
Nancy, can we just stop for a minute? Does anybody have any questions for Nancy at this point? She's going through some basic things for the younger neurosurgeons here, and she's going to get into the repair of CSF leak soon. Anybody have any questions they want to raise for her? Okay, I don't see anyone. Good. Go ahead, Nancy, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, great. L5 nerve root deficits, what's the best way to pick this up? Ask your patient to walk across the floor. Okay, you could do tandem gait testing at the same time. Ask them to walk in their heels. You can pick up that foot drop when you hear that sort of slop. It's a much more effective way than just examining them than when they're sitting. Again, it picks up a more subtle foot drop. You may or may not have a loss of the ankle response, and then they'll have loss of sensation, maybe accompanying it, maybe not, over the lateral calf and the dorsum of the foot, the typical S1 nerve root problem. Ask them to stand on their toes as they're walking down the hallway. Can't do it on one side, that's your deficit. No ankle response and a loss of pin over the lateral aspect of the foot and dorsally as well. The next point is compression of the corticoina. Does the patient have a corticoina syndrome? Everybody seems to forget about the fact that patients can have a partial corticoina syndrome, but it's as much of an emergency as the total corticoina syndrome. They may have unilateral weakness. They may have unilateral sensory loss. They may have sphincter function, dysfunction. They may have some sexual dysfunction. They may have perineal numbness just on one side. But again, you know, with these massive central disc herniations, you want to know whether or not these patients have a partial corticoid syndrome, just like you want to know, do they have a total corticoid syndrome? But unfortunately, it might not be the neurosurgeons or the spine surgeons, but the emergency room physicians, the hospitalists, our other colleagues, the nurses in the hospital, the PAs, the nurse practitioners, they don't recognize that somebody may have a partial rather than this classic corticoid syndrome where they have total paralysis, saddle anesthesia, urinary retention, bowel incontinence, sexual dysfunction, et cetera. And here's your massive sequestrated disc and the urinary incontinence. Well, what are the surgical options? And really, when we're talking about spinal fluid leaks, we're talking about surgeons often choosing the wrong surgical options, not having adequate access to removing the pathology at hand, be it a disc, be it stenosis, be it synovial cyst, be it other. A unilateral laminotomy, great operation, but especially in a younger, healthier patient without any significant spondylotic disease. Extruded sequestrated disc at that level or maybe just below. By the way, you're not going to find the superiorly extruded disc at the mid-pedicle level. You're not going to find the foraminal disc or the extra-foraminal disc in this case with that kind of exposure. But good operation if you have the right indication. Here is an extended laminotomy. We used to call it ipsa contra, where you can look for the disc herniation. You're doing some gentle retraction, but you may have a superior and inferior nerve root deficit in that patient. If you have a foraminal disc herniation or a far lateral extrusion, here you have to far laterally take off a little bit of the lateral aspect of the facet, remove the intertransversarius ligament and fascia, and then expose the superiorly exiting nerve root and the extrusion underneath it. But here you have medial as well as foraminal, really far lateral exposure to make sure you are not sacrificing the nerve root just so that you can preserve that pars interarticularis. Unilateral hemilaminectomy, full facetectomy. For foraminal and far lateral disc, this may be your best exposure. By the way, in your older patients who have significant spondylotic disease or spontaneous fusion at 5-1, you may not have to do any fusion in this case. And again, your superior foraminally exiting nerve root, your dorsal root ganglia, these patients may have exquisite pain because of the dorsal root ganglia being compromised. And again, this gives you adequate exposure above and below. For those who are doing a far lateral disc and they have never done one before, I highly recommend using this exposure because otherwise you may damage the nerve root getting to where you have to go. And it allows you to remaining focused on where the pathology is. You can follow that foraminally exiting nerve root laterally, foraminally, and far laterally. This will help you avoid damaging or going right through that nerve root trying to take out the disc. I've seen too many cases of far lateral discs where the surgeon goes in, does the routine exposure, and then closes and leaves the entire disc behind. Oh, by the way, I've also seen cases where they do an incision, they go down into the subcutaneous tissue for maybe a centimeter, and then they close, claiming in this long operative note that they took out a lateral disc with foraminal, et cetera. I mean, it goes on forever. Remember, watch out. Some of these operative notes bear little relationship to the operation that's been completed. Here,
so, let's just stop for a second here. Nancy, there's a tremendous amount of being written about one, minimally invasive surgery, and two, even using endoscopic surgery. How does that stand in regard to all of that entails more equipment, more expenses? What is the result? And is doing the standard procedure that you've outlined here for many of these things is good everywhere in the world and is have excellent outcomes?
Yeah. Well, I'm also going to get to that very shortly, but minimally invasive is minimally effective. I've done reviews of a lot of minimally invasive cases. They don't have adequate exposure. They get not only the CSF leaks, but they get neural injuries associated with it. Or they for the spinal fluid leak, when we talk about closure, half the time they just close. They say, oh, well, the blood clot's going to take care of it. And then they have a tremendous incidence of recurrent leaks. But I'm going to get to that shortly, Jim, because I think it's a great question. So I'm just going to finish the coronal hemilaminectomy, where you take off a half of the lamina above and below. It gives you bilateral exposure of the exiting nerve roots and the thecal sac, good access to a central disc herniation with especially downbiting curettes, which are like this. I assume everybody knows what a downbiting curette is like. Obviously, the old-fashioned lumbar laminectomy can be, in some instances, the best operation you're going to do, because with horrendous stenosis, you basically have your spinous process coming right down. You've got maybe 2 to 3 millimeters at most of lamina on other side. If you use the laminectomy and remove the spinous process with angling your microscope, you actually can do your multi-level or single-level medial facetectomies, really preserving the facets, avoiding doing effusion by using a laminectomy approach, as opposed to many will go in and they'll just do bilateral full facetectomies and create their iatrogenic instability that then they have to go on to fuse. So it's just something to remember and think about. Minimally invasive discectomies, more CSF leaks, more other problems. Here are some of the references. We'll show you some references at the end of the talk today as well. Here's your metrics discectomy coming down. And again, you know, you're going to have very limited exposure with these getting these leaks. And I just recounted to here, you know, you've got tubes. They may be 3 to 9 centimeters long. They might be an attractive alternative, especially in your more morbidly obese patients. But again, the ability to maneuver with these is markedly limited. 16 to 26 millimeter diameter. I mean, 25 millimeters is an inch. You don't have a lot of maneuverability in these cases. You're not going to be able to put some of your instruments down. You're certainly not going to be able to get a curette down there safely, because you're not going to be able to get through the tube and around your neural structures adequately. So, Jim, to answer your question, it markedly limits your ability to work in a 360 degree fashion. It markedly limits you because lots of times you come right down on the nerve tissue. You may be creating more retraction injuries trying to do this. And again, you may be creating more CSF leaks because you don't have enough room to work around the nerve tissue, much less adequately extend your decompression so you're fully decompressing the nerve tissue and allowing yourself to get in and around the nerve tissue to take out whatever your pathology is. A lot of the minimally invasive studies show more post-op clots and infections, recurrent but very often residual or retained disc fragments, new neurological deficits because of retraction or the residual discs, and sometimes just frequent paralysis because of sometimes just going right through the cauda equina, and major time CSF leaks. This is a study, European Journal of Spine, 2015. The incidence of CSF leaks in over 4,000 spinal surgery cases, 1.7% disc. This is what I mentioned at the very beginning of today's lecture, 3.6% with spinal stenosis, and a whopping near 15% revision rate with previous operations. And here's an example of a patient who had a prior multi-level decompressive procedure, 4.5 to 5.1, massive recurrent CSF leak. Again, if somebody goes in and does a minimally invasive operation, very few can make the mental and physical and appropriate adjustments to opening that case or extending the procedure sufficiently to bring in the microscope and actually do a formal repair of the dura. In other words, most of these CSF leaks occur due to poor exposure. They're going to get more leaks and more complex leaks. They're going to get more full failed repairs. And in fact, in lots of instances, in some medical legal cases, they obviously didn't do a repair at all. Again, the operative note may have this, you know, multiple paragraphs about I did this, I did that, and there's no evidence that they actually physically, with the bony exposure that you can document on a CAT scan, could not possibly get in the instruments that they claimed. You're going to have more post-op recurrent leaks and, very importantly, more morbidity, including more post-operative adhesive arachnoiditis, postural hypertension, motor, sensory, reflex, sexual dysfunction, you name it, they have it. And actually on CAT scans, you can see the brain sagging. You can see dural enhancement and other problems resulting from it. And again, this is what that leak may look like. So now we're getting finally to the CSF leak repair. I invite anybody to make any comments as we go along. We're going to go over briefly the anatomy of the meninges, repair techniques, using the microscope if available. That's certainly optimal, better than Luke if you have it, especially because your assistant can then actually see what you're doing and help. And intraoperative monitoring with SCPs and EMG may also be extremely helpful.
Let's just hold for a second here, Nancy. I don't know where that noise, let me find where that's coming from. But anybody have any questions they want to ask at this point? Where we've got about, we started about 10 minutes after 8. So we've got...
I just raised my hand. Yeah. I don't know if I can
Professor
go ahead.
Go ahead, Dr. Professor Kaba, please do.
The point about all this is in low-income countries, depends on the kind of microscope you use. We all don't have Kenovo 900 or Pentero, whatever. You use the loops, and maybe your assistant don't have. The big leakages can easily be seen. The question then comes with the small leakages, all right? Where in other centers, probably if you inject some kind of spy agent, like for instance, you might be able to see it coming. You do Vasava maneuver, you might be able. In your experience, what are the topical agents that you can use, apply to the dura, that could actually help you in situations where the leakage is so small, you cannot actually suture?
I'm going to get to that shortly because I'm going to go over different options. In instances like that, sometimes if you can't get a suture in, you can't get a dural staple in, you can take a small piece of a muscle patch graft and put that in and maybe suture it to something else on the side. Sometimes you can actually use DuraGen or microfibrillar collagen. You can use Avitene. I would caution against using gel foam and Surgicel. They've got to be removed because otherwise they're going to cause compressive changes. Different fibrin sealants can be used. Some you have to watch out. You don't want to make it a thick layer because the thick layers can cause neurological deficits. But I would say, number one, a small piece of muscle from the patient, and you take a hammer and you splay it out and you put it right over there, and then you can put a small piece of onlay DuraGen. And if you're really concerned about it, you can actually, there's a kind of DuraGen that you can actually suture in place over that. And that in combination with the fibrin sealants can be very effective for treating those.
Dr. Kaba, Professor Kaba, what do you do?
All right, so we have my little experience in the last 20 years has to do with different agents, like she said, sometimes a little bit of muscle fat.
Is fat?
And then recently, about 3 years ago, I found this material called Vericet TM. I think it's a German product. I'm not too sure, but Vericet. And it's so effective in sealing small holes. You apply it and it just gets bigger. Even when you're operating on intraventricular tumors and you use it, it's quite effective. And you don't, because when we try to suture very small, tiny, I remember just last week we were doing a case, a spine case, and then we had a challenge. We did a Valsalva, we found out it was leaking. We put in fluorescent dye, we saw it come in, but it was so difficult to suture. And when we applied it, it did work. But then I was kind of like, okay, from my point, part of the world, maybe there are more novel items that you could use that would actually seal it topically. And I don't know. That is why I was just asking to know if there are many more developments in that area. We all know that from the beginning, back in those days, we used the bone.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the muscle, the little fat, and we try to seal them. But you can share your experience if you have any modern items that you use.
I know that in the 70s and the 80s, Joe Rantzoff, who I trained with at NYU, at one point he got a leak and it was doing a pituitary and it was a vascular leak, et cetera. He used crazy glue, but crazy glue is not supposed to be used for this at all. Number two, fat is not a good product or tissue to use because it shrinks, it disappears and goes away. What was the other product that you mentioned? Because I was not familiar with that.
Yeah, I said Vericet, V-E-R-I-S-T, Vericet. Vericet TM.
There's a different name, I think, here.
I just got it like that when I had an opportunity for separation of the conjoined twins in Ghana. We ordered and we got that, and it's been very effective.
Is it like a dural repair or a dural alternative?
I don't know much about it, and I wanted to know your experience if it's been used.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to show you in great detail very shortly exactly what we use.
How long is the next part take, Nancy? Because we may have to have you do that the next time.
Okay. Let's just try a few minutes of this.
Okay.
We all know the different layers of the dura. The repair technique, first of all, you have to admit that you have the leak. You have to identify it and repair it. Okay. Interrupted sutures. Do not use a running suture. One running suture falls apart, the whole wound falls apart. Very important, if you have 7-0 Gore-Tex sutures, use it. It's a non-resorbable suture. Do not use a Neurolon. It unfurls and it's a weaker closure. So Gore-Tex sutures, the needle is smaller than the suture itself, so it'll plug the needle hole, and a Neurolon, it just unfurls and it loosens. It's not good. Muscle patch graft with your interrupted sutures, it's the way to go, not your running sutures. And the interrupted sutures are the best way. And again, do not use fat. Fat resorbs. Use a muscle patch graft. Here's an example of a repair. Here you're interrupted dural sutures. And in between them, if you have access to it, microdural staples. If you don't have them, just put in more sutures. And you may need to put a patch graft in addition to that. And what you do is you just save your needles and then you sew in the muscle patch graft. You're going to always want to check with your watertight closure with a Valsalva. And here is after we've taken out, obviously, a multi-level tumor. And here are your dural sutures on either side. What you're going to do is you're going to flip them over and you're going to put in your interrupted sutures here. And then you're going to put your dural staples. Everybody can see the dural staples that are in between here. What you do then on top of that is take one of your fibrin sealants. I would use Tocil. It resorbs in about a week. Dural sealants or Duracil is approved, but it's been glommed and found to produce quadriplegia and paraplegia. So I don't know that I would go that way. You can use onlay Duragen or microfibrillar collagen. This is what I was speaking to Dr. Kaba about. You can take a small piece of this and put it just onlay over where your leak happens to be. You can then put two layers of fibrin sealant on top of that. Your alternative also to use a suturable Duragen on top of this. So here, your regular Duragen, one layer of fibrin sealant, put your sutural Duragen on top of that, and then put your fibrin sealant final layer on top of that as well. Here's just an example of a minimally invasive laminotomy that was done. They refused to acknowledge the repair, or in theory, they did a poor repair. They didn't open. They didn't do a more extensive bony decompression to adequately repair the leak. They ignored it postoperatively, despite the patient's postoperative intracranial hypotension and other symptoms and signs of a CSF leak. They delayed doing an MR for months, and then basically it caused adhesive arachnoiditis that was a permanent irreversible deficit in this patient. Postoperatively recognizing, adhesive arachnoiditis, these are your normal axial MR scans of your lumbar spinal canal. And here, normal axial study, but clumped nerve roots. Okay, and here, alternatively, is the empty sac sign where the nerve roots are clumped around the perimeter is what you may be seeing. Classically, you're going to want to repair these leaks doing your open procedure to find out where the source happens to be. And remember, some of these might be real pseudomeningocele with nerve roots extruding into that sac. The best way to treat these CSF leaks is avoid them in the first place with the correct operation. Diagnose them with the MR scan. You're not going to see anything with the CT studies. And then do the operation. Avoid the leaks with good exposure. Give up the minimally invasive. Make your incision longer. Open the vertebral bodies as you need to. Use a microscope if you have access to it. Use the loops if you have that. Use 7-0 Gore-Tex sutures or a non-resorbable suture. Do not use Neurolon, which is a monofilament suture that's going to unfurl. Add to that repair staples or muscle patch graft if you need it. Fibrin sealant and the Duragens can be used. diagnose a recurrent leak on an MR scan, treat the leaks ASAP early, and correctly repair the leaks. Basically, this is the premise. The early bird diagnoses and repairs the CSF leaks early. You don't dawdle, you don't wait, you don't deny. And thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Nancy. We appreciate it. I think we've run out of time here. And Estrada, maybe we should ask Gilbert, are you still there? Gilbert de Chamberlain? Well, yes, there you are. First of all, as we defer to your tremendous experience, any questions or comments or suggestions from what you've from the meeting and what you've heard, what we should do in the future? I think you're muted. Yes.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Okay, yeah. No, it's a good start, you know. I noted that there are 40 people looking at and participating, and it's a good start. And important is to share the information, to repeat the announcements, and every day, maybe 1 week before, and to prepare the course and share the course before the presentation. Yes, it's a good start, Jim. Yes, let's go ahead.
Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to make some comments? Estrada, do you want to see if anybody else wants to do that?
Professor, do you permit? Okay, go ahead, please.
No, please, please.
Professor, if you permit me, there is an excellent book named Sciatica by a spine neurosurgeon from Tunisia. It is on the book review of SNI. I reviewed it. It is highly recommended for the young neurosurgeon to look at that. It's a little bit expensive, but it is 1,500 pages, and I highly recommend they order it for the department so the residents have access to that book. And it is online also. And it's named Sciatica. You can look at the book review on the SNI. I highly recommend, it's beautifully written, it's very vast, and I highly recommend that one. The other thing is that maybe Dr. Nancy can do one talk in future about corpectomy and anterior approach for the disc removal, which is traditionally done. It has a lot of side effect. And if anytime she can make a lecture for that one, so we can hear her opinion also, because it's a little bit controversial. Some neurosurgeons do it, but if you can arrange that for us, we appreciate it. Thank you for everybody for its participation.
There's a button down in the bottom where you can check out. You can just open it up and check off and leave us a comment on your reaction to the meeting. We're going to, Professor Mugwambi, any comments from you? We appreciate the preparation your group did and the excellent discussion that went with it. Any comments you'd like to make?
My only comment is, first of all, to thank everybody who has participated. And then the other comment I'd like to make is from the attendance chat, the University of Nairobi residents, well represented, and also from our colleagues from Africa, several were able to turn up. Let's advertise these meetings. As I said, I had to take the initiative to start the presentation, but now probably this is the first and only presentation I'll be giving, because I'll have many of my other colleagues in University of Nairobi who are very keen to present, and they have a lot of very interesting cases which they'll be presenting. And then, of course, we would like to hear cases from other colleagues from Africa and how they're handling the challenges which they face. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Estrada, thank you. Estrada really put in a major effort to get all this organized. We really appreciate it. Any comments or thoughts you have? And what about the next meeting?
No, I think this was quite successful, and thanks Dr. Mugwambi and Dr. Epstein for your presentations, and I appreciate the active participation that we have from participants. We will convene the program committee to devise the program for the next meeting. For people who are on this call from Africa, if you have interest, please send me an email or send Jim an email about potential topics for which you'd like to make presentations. But I think we have a good start, and I appreciate the participation of everyone. And Jim, again, thank you for putting this all together in the first place.
Okay, well,
like I think has his doctor, hand up, and so does Professor Kaba.
Yeah, Dr. Yes. Kaba. Yeah.
Dr. Gilbert de Chambonot, wow. It's been a long time. I met you in Brazil.
Yes, I remember, yes.
Still in 2011.
We are close.
Maybe you remember me in Porto de Galinas.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I remember.
2011 to now, I don't even remember how long that was. By then you were in France or something.
Come and visit that's me great in Ivory Coast.
Yeah. Oh, you've relocated to Ivory Coast. That's great.
Yes,
anyway, I was just going to make a comment on the previous speaker who spoke about the books. Sometimes in our part of the world, it's quite expensive to buy the books and all that. But if we have online versions, we can make them available. And as institutions, we can easily subscribe or get our residents to get some of them online. But buying the book itself is quite expensive and sometimes difficult to actually achieve. So if you have any material, just let us know the link, and then we can see how best we can acquire to go deep into it. Thank you.
Yes, the book is available online also. It's by the TM company. It is online and you can apply for it. So all the residents can go through it. And it's really a beautiful and highly recommended, especially for the anatomy they have. As it's described, it's beautiful.
All right. Well, okay. Always remember that everything on SNI is free. There are some books on there that are free if you look in the menu on SNI, which is the journal, and SNI Digital. We've got over 100 videos now. Nancy has at least 7 of them, which you can go and hear in more detail. The lectures, the references there if you want to follow, and that's also free. So, and that has discussion. So thank you all for coming, and thank you everybody for participating. We appreciate the comments at the end. I'm just reading here, and thank you again.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you so much.
And thank you too for organizing and moderating. And thanks to colleagues. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Okay. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
See you next time.
Thank you, Jim, for the major, major undertaking you've accomplished.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Thank you, Dr. Epstein, for the lecture. It was interesting, honestly.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. And this recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions, comments, or requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. The Foundation supports 2 journals to educate physicians, neurosurgeons, and people around the world. Surgical Neurology International is a 2D internet journal. Nancy Epstein is the editor-in-chief. The web address is sni.global. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is the second. It's a 3D video journal. It's interactive with discussion, and its web address is snidigital.org. Both are free 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territory, is the third largest in readership of neurosurgical journals in the world. SNI Digital is now in 88 countries after 3 months and is the first video journal of neurosurgery. The goal of the foundation is helping people throughout the world. In addition, the foundation supports the Medical News Network to bring truthful medical and science news to the world. Thank you very much.